You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Feel like who Art Ed?
Try to spice it.
Who Art Ed?
Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, weekly art history for all ages. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today I am continuing my series of artist interviews. I am very excited to be bring back an artist you have heard from before. Once again, I've got Tom Deslongchamp. Thank you so much for giving me some more of your time.
Oh, yeah. I'm happy to be here. Hello.
And I am happy to have you here. I have talked about you on my other show, Art Smart, and we did an earlier episode back in the winter where I did one episode about you, talking about you with a friend of mine, and we were focused on your marker technique. And then I had you on for an episode talking about one of your early influences for our Bob Ross episode. But today I wanted to do something a little bit different. I wanted to focus on your animation, because I know you have done quite a bit of interesting stuff with animation that I'm going to be honest, like I look at it and I don't even know how you do live action animation. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I wanted to bring you on today because I just think there are so many interesting different ways that people go about the, creating, and you're a multidisciplinary artist. And I wanted to get at how you go about creating work. So today we're going to have a little bit more traditional interview. But before we get to that, I do want to put you on the spot because this episode is going to drop as we're entering the final round of my Arts Madness tournament. And I just want to make it uncomfortable for you by putting you on the spot and saying, it looks to me like our final will be Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night up against Katsushika Hokusai's Great Wave off of Kanagawa. And I'm curious, which do you like better?
Well, I'm more familiar with Van Gogh's work in general, so my initial inclination is to lean towards Van Gogh, but to be honest, the Starry Night painting is not one of my favorites of his, and I actually think the Great Wave painting is fantastic. Like, it's like such a beautiful image. I never really get tired of seeing it, even though it's sort of a cliche of sorts because it shows up everywhere now. But I'd go with the Great Wave, honestly.
Really? I am surprised. I mean, not surprised that you would like the Great Wave. It's a phenomenal woodcut print. I mean, it's everywhere for a reason. The movement across that composition is just, it's beautiful. And just the technical achievement of it, I'm always blown away when I think about like carving out so many individual stamps for each color and stuff like that. I mean, printmakers, my hat is off to you. But I'm curious, why is the Starry Night not such a favorite of yours?
Well, his work is, you know, the strokes, the way he kind of bites into his images with his vigorous constructions of like systems of movement and stuff. The Starry Night feels kind of like a mural at a kid's school, but maybe because it's been used as a mural at a kid's school, maybe, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, Maybe it's because it's oversaturated in my visual like experience. Maybe I would like it more if it hadn't been regarded and shown so many times, kind of like a overplayed song on the radio.
Yeah.
But there's just something, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's not a bad painting. It's just not the one that I'm like, oh yeah, I want to put that on my wall with a print, you know, like I'd probably more quickly put the wave one, because the wave one, yeah, the process, the woodcut is incredible. Like knowing that each layer color is a hand carved piece of wood blows my mind. I appreciate that. And also just its balance of color and the way it makes me feel when I look at it. I mean, a painting at night, I mean, that was rare for Van Gogh. I mean, well, more rare than the day paintings of fields and stuff. Well, I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. I haven't researched that. But I guess I like the colors that come out when he does the more day paintings than the night ones that are more like purple and black and stuff. But, you know, I don't know.
That's fair enough. I think I have a nostalgia for the Starry Night because it was one of those ones where when Van Gogh and Gauguin exhibit came to the Art Institute of Chicago, I was in high school maybe, and it was one of my first times seeing a work that I had seen in books, I had seen in slides, I had seen in class, but to see it in person, that was really impactful for me to see that heavy impasto like on the actual canvas. That was something that you know stuck with me even decades later. But also, I personally am just really interested to see how this one comes out because of the fact that when I look at Starry Night, I almost see like an echo of Hokusai's Great Wave in the movement across the sky. Like the movement of the brushstrokes across the sky feels like a tsunami wave or something rolling across there. And I know that Van Gogh was very much influenced by Japanese woodcuts, and specifically Hokusais were among the most widely distributed. So I always see that, and I find it really interesting that a sort of impressionist or post-impressionist artist is up against a UKOE printmaker in the finals there. Just a reminder for everyone, you can weigh in on your favorite at whoartedpodcast.com/vote. And now on to the actual topic for today, Tom Des Longchamp. So to just get started with like you and your background, like can you just give us where'd you grow up, your interests, hobbies, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I grew up in SeaTac, Washington, which is right by the airport and outside Seattle or south of Seattle. And I grew up in kind of a funny place where there was a lot of degraded structures because of the expansion of the airport, where my parents bought a house in this like kind of nook next to a bunch of land that had been evacuated slowly because of plane dropping toxic chemicals, you know, and noise. So there's just this empty landscape that's forest now that has like random concrete staircases in the middle of it where there used to be houses and stuff, and there's just blank roads. So I used to explore that stuff with my friends, ride my bikes everywhere. I was very active as a kid, very physical. Like I was doing karate and watching a lot of TV and trying to recreate things I saw on TV, jumping off things, climbing trees. All sorts of active physical things.
Sounds like you're already halfway to Radioactive Man or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I loved, like ninjas were fascinating to me. Like I got a ninja suit and I used to run around in it and be a ninja every Halloween, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah.
I think there was something in the water those years or something. Like ninjas were like really big for a brief period, right? Like there were like the Surf Ninjas movie and like other like random stuff just like as we were growing up. Late 80s, early 90s, right?
I think it was a direct result of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for sure, because they were like this out of nowhere animation not tied to a big studio that had a merchandising like explosion. I mean, everyone had Ninja Turtles. I mean, it's crazy. Like, it's still a legacy that endures despite being an independent creative thing, that those comic, I forget their names. It was like two people came up with it and then they made a show and then it just exploded. It's crazy.
Well, the show exploded, and that was like the only way that I knew about any Renaissance artists for the longest period. But then the movies were hilariously like low budget too. I think Corey Feldman voiced one of them for like $1,000 or something like that. And like if you look carefully, you can see some PAs that wandered on set and were just like hiding in the background, trying not to be noticed on camera, like duck under a table and stuff like that. But I guess
they were funny.
Yeah. We grew up in an odd time, but
yeah,
with all of that sort of ridiculousness going on and the awesome adventures happening, like what made you start to look at art as something to pursue? And when did it sort of shift into something from hobby to more serious for you?
Yeah. Well, I drew a lot as a kid and was kind of known for it in school. Like, you know, I would draw little characters and things and people were like, well, you're good at drawing. I'm like, thanks, you know. But I guess it was somewhere around middle school or seventh grade or so when we were doing a report. I may have even mentioned this to you before, but I did a report on Van Gogh because I had to choose someone who was deceased to like talk about and do a little report about. And I dove so deep and was so moved by his life and the crazy tragedy of it and the passion and like just that he made all this work in such a short period of time. And that really put made an impression on me to explore drawing in a more serious way. I wasn't even sure what, but I started with self-portraits because Van Gogh did a lot of those and I loved those. Like there were some of my favorite pieces of his as far as people go and stuff. And so I was doing these self-portraits in my sketchbook, looking in the mirror. And I remember the first time it clicked and I was like, oh my God, like I'm doing it. I'm drawing me right now. Like I'm capturing it. And I was lit up in my mind by the feeling that I had crossed into, I mean, I guess you could call it realism. It wasn't realism yet, but it was that I was seeing something. I'm like, whoa, no, that actually looks like me sitting here. You know, it's not just like an iconic version of myself with two eyes, nose, mouth, you know, like, which is kind of like what kids do earlier on.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, I can see it. I can see I can trace what I'm seeing with my hand, you know, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I know what you mean. There's something almost empowering about that sense of accomplishment when like you finally feel like you can render something realistically or what's in your mind, you can actually put into the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right on that? Like, is that what you're?
Yeah, actually, it's a tremendous power to wield all of a sudden. Where, because you know, I remember, you know, when you have like a box of markers or colored pencils, I remember getting really frustrated with them or watercolor sets that were just really bad and cheap and stuff. And I remember, you know, having to make a poster about like fire safety or something. You know, like. They always kind of had the same kind of look because you had markers to use. So you just draw like line drawings of like iconic kind of things. And, but man, to break out of, into like actually observing reality and then recreating it was very, very exciting to me. So it really set me off on a path of trying to paint and draw. In some form, I mean, it was a lot harder with paint. I had a tough time with that. I didn't grasp color at the time, I was better with outlining. I would mm-hmm. I was kind of addicted to the outlines of thinking everything as having lines around it, you know. And that was helpful for me to bridge reality to paper. Was just, what shape is it? You know, what is it? How do I draw the shape of it? And it took me a long time to really, really fathom value, like darkness and light, and to see light for what it is. It takes a long time to see light instead of just putting what you see into categories of like, oh, jeans, blue jeans. Oh, get the blue out, blue. You know, like I remember just doing that. Like, I'm like, oh, it's a green field. Okay, green. Mm-hmm. You know, fill it in like a coloring book. You know, like I remember being frustrated. I'm like, why doesn't it look good? Why? It's because like there's actually colors more vast, a vast world of depth, and it's not just one hue, one tone slathered across the canvas. But yeah,
well, I think you're right. That's such a good insight in that, you know, you talk about how you start off with like, it's the symbol of the face with the two dots and the smile and stuff like that. And then you get into like really focusing on the contours and like the outlines of everything. And then you fill it in, but to actually see the color and see the range of values that are in there and all of that sort of stuff, it's different. You don't have what we would call like a schema for it. It's something that you just, after looking and studying and making and experimenting, you start to get this sense of it. It becomes a little bit more intuitive. And I think what's funny about it is you have to study a lot of theory in order to gain that intuition. You know what I mean? Like, in order to just see it.
Anyway, even when you train yourself, like I still have times now where I'm like, wait, what is happening? Like what visually is I had a commission recently, a portrait commission, where they sent me a photo to work from. And I was like, I can't get it right. I don't know why. What's wrong with me? I've been doing this for so long. I should be able to do this. I was going crazy.
Yeah.
And it's like, there are scenarios that are like just right, that are really wrong or different, you know, than I'm the idealized version that I would prefer. Like I realized that the people in the photo were backlit, but the photo had been adjusted to brighten their faces, and it looked natural when you looked at it. But when you went to like recreate it, it was very tricky to the brain. And they also used a very long lens, which flattens features in a strange way, makes your necks really thick, you know, like it makes your body look different. And it, there was just, when I rendered it, it looked weird. I was like, so I had to like kind of adjust the drawing to make it feel more natural. It was a very strange experience. So, yeah.
That's interesting though. Cause that gets to me at the fact that like we have to draw a certain amount of what we see, but then there's always some adjustment. And just to bring this back like full circle to like it kind of reminds me of the process from what I've read about Van Gogh's Starry Night, where it was almost a synthesis of different views from his window from the asylum at like different times of the evening, and then he adjusted it to make the composition work. Where, like, you know, the cypress trees were really farther away and he wouldn't have been able to see the town from that window. But, like, sometimes you have to realize, like, the composition is its own thing. And you're not recreating reality. You're creating a new composition. And it's funny now as I'm thinking back and I'm making that connection with Van Gogh and you talked about that influence. In another episode, I was talking to Herb Williams, a sculptor who works with crayons. And he was another artist. I should probably plug like the Art of Ed. I'm doing an article about artists doing stuff with interesting materials. And I talked about Herb Williams with the crayons, and I talked about you with the markers. And in that interview, I was talking to Herb Williams, and I had mentioned you with the marker drawings, and he starts looking at your drawings, and the first comparison he made was to Vincent van Gogh and the textures and the way that you do stuff. And I just thought that was really interesting. And a flattering comparison.
Yeah. I'm very flattered by that. Cause van Gogh's one of my favorites. I could just like eat his images forever, you know, like, I don't know, just, I have a big thick book of all of his work, and I just love turning the pages, never get tired of it.
Same. But I do want to move beyond the paintings and drawings and get into your sort of other major line of work, another body of work, because you do a lot of stuff with animation that I find really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about like how you got into animation, you know, some of the artists or animators that have shaped your approach to that? Because your animations stylistically are very different from the marker drawings.
Yeah, they are like two sides of a coin. I mean, like in they're opposites. Yeah. And it's funny. So I would say that, you know, animation as a concept and a method, you know, first appeared to me, you know, from television and movies and stuff. I was a Nickelodeon kid, watched Rugrats and Ren and Stimpy and Doug, and loved that era of Disney, Aladdin, you know, all that, Little Mermaid, all those films coming out. I was just a little kid during that time. Ninja Turtles, we were talking about. Yeah. So all of that. I was very aware of what animation was because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. And I watched a lot of TV. My parents would record cartoons off TV in the 80s. And we had little tapes called Kid Shows 1 and Kid Shows 2. These long 6-hour tapes of like various, you know, cartoons.
Yeah.
So that was an early influence, just like being inundated with moving images. And what ended up happening was my parents were very into documentation, like with a video camera. From 1990 onward, we had a video camera, and I loved taking videos or being on camera. I liked to entertain and flip around. I would set up pillows and do flips. My mom would film me and stuff. And I would dress up. So there was this point where, in middle school, it was actually around the same time as I did the report on Van Gogh, where I was getting serious about art. I was like, what if I take a really short video, like tap the record button and then tap it off, like did it, you know, just like really short duration. What's the shortest duration I can get? And I was like, it's like a picture, because this is before digital cameras and stuff, you know. And so I got like a little figurine guy with a little skateboarder character, and I made the skateboarder move across my desk without me touching it, because I would take a little exposure or a little picture and then move it and then take another picture, and the camera wobbled a little bit. So the frame,
yeah,
it was very primitive stop motion. The stop motion's the term for it, because you take all these little images, and then they in a sequence, they make movement, the illusion of movement. And so I think that was the gateway for me to thinking about creating animation. But it was very limited, because, you know, I could only get like 2 frames per second, 2 pictures a second.
Yeah.
So that's like
I've seen a lot of the stop motions at 2 frames a second as I've taught stop motion to students who then play with the frame rate. They're like, a 5-second animation, that's too short, and so they just lower the frame rate.
Cheaters. Oh my gosh.
So But I do have to ask you, because it sounds to me like you sort of stumbled onto stop motion almost on your own. Were you aware of stop motion as a process and everything like that? Or was this just like an outgrowth of your experimentation?
So I think I was aware because, you know, this is after Nightmare Before Christmas came out and James and the Giant Peach. Mm. And I loved Nightmare Before Christmas, and I loved Tim Burton stuff. And so I had, and you know, I was a big Pee Wee Herman fan, and in Pee Wee's Big Adventure, there's in his dream, there's dinosaurs that move, and they use stop motion on a show a lot. So I was kind of aware that there was this weird, freaky way to move stuff, you know, physically. Like, I knew it wasn't a computer, and I think I probably saw like a documentary, like snippet on TV once or something. I must have seen the idea or saw a behind the scenes thing about Nightmare Before Christmas or something, because that's, I went into it very intentionally. I think I actually started also with drawing on paper and taking pictures. I did a report at school about, the To Kill a Mockingbird. I had to do a report on that. So okay. I mixed video of me talking as like a character and then going to scenes that I drew on paper. And then I would have a character move across the thing. So that actually might have been the very first time, but it was kind of boring because it was for school, you know?
But also a brilliant way to give a boring presentation.
Yeah, I mean, no, people loved it, and the teacher loved it, and it was so much more fun to make a video than write a paper. Oh my gosh. What ended up blowing open that exploration was the arrival of, in my life at least, of it was called Macromedia Flash at the time. It's now Adobe Animate. But it was a program that I saved up my money, purchased, and all of a sudden I had the control to construct animation in a software program where I had way more control. I could control how fast images played, you know, and I could change the art. However, I could bring in images from a digital camera. You know, it was a few years after that initial camcorder experiment. It was probably around 2000, year 2000 or so, when I was just entering high school.
If I recall correctly, you went to RISD studying animation and film, right?
Yeah, I did. You know, I was kind of, you know, I was doing a lot of animation already and video in high school. And so when I went, I mean, people all around me were like, oh, so you're probably going to like go into film and animation, right? And I was like, well, I don't know. I might go into painting. You know, like I was like wanting to keep my options open because I loved art like entirely. Like, and I even had like a little, I fell in love with architecture for like 1 or 2 weeks. And everyone was like, are you crazy? You're an animator guy. Like, don't go into architecture, you idiot. You know, like, and it turned out to be true. I was just enamored with some mind-blowing new concepts about space and that blew my mind. And in the end I was like, oh, okay, I gotta pick a major. I'm not gonna do painting. I don't relate with the people that are doing that. I'm gonna be animation. So yeah, it was but I also took film classes too. I kind of did both. I did video and film and animation, but my degree project was animation. I had to create projects for that. So yeah.
So as you were studying that formally, were you still doing the stuff? Was that Flash based animation? Were you doing the 3D rendering? Were you doing, like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. So I really, really enjoyed that we got to go back to the roots of filmmaking in general. And we actually shot, my early animation classes were, we used Bolexes, which are film cameras that you hand wind and hand load. And they're 16 millimeter frames. And it was fascinating to me that we were actually using these tools that have been around for, you know, the last 100 years. I mean, the Bolex, I can't remember what year it's from, but they were, you know, being used a lot in the 40s and 50s and stuff. And or maybe even earlier. I don't know. I don't remember the history. But so I had to light a, we did sand animation, we did paper, we did cutout animation. We had to learn how to light a scene and then take the exposures by hand, where it, you take a click and then it, yeah, it moves it one frame, and then you click and you have to wind it to do it. And then we had to develop the film, and then we had to edit the film on the big Steenbeck, I think that's what they were called, machines, that where you wind everything up and then you have to sync it with sound. You have to create the sound on magnetic tape by transferring sounds to from CDs to magnetic tape, sync it with the film. It was very cool because, like, all the, you know, Adobe Premiere or the editing programs that you edit video, they're all based off of that process, but they've morphed over time because, yeah, of software being removed from the physical process. Like with bins, we had film bins where you cut bits of film and you have a film bin so it doesn't get dirty. It's like a little cloth bin that it hangs and dangles into and stuff, and got little razor cutter things for cutting the film and taping it together. And my goodness, I loved that process, even though it was limiting because it was hard.
Yeah.
Like how much work it took to capture a dinky little animation. But simultaneously, I was still going home to my dorm and making animation in Flash because it was easy. You know, I was always using the internet as a platform to share work, and
yeah,
it was immediate. Like I could dink around one night. I keep saying dink. I was playing around and I would just be like, oh, well, that one's done. Save it out, put it on a web page and share it, and then see what people think, you know, and, or put it on newgrounds.com or something, you know. It's like, so I was doing the film stuff and digital animation, but then as I, when I got to junior year, we started to have more freedom to use different methods. And I did an in-between method for my junior project where it was physical art, cell painting, where you mm-hmm. you paint, well, you do it on paper first to sketch it out, and you test the timing with digital testers, like a little webcam on a thing pointed down at your paper, and you capture it temporarily to make sure the frames are looking right, and then you make the final version of the art, and then you trace that, you know, onto cell, then you paint it. Then you capture that with a digital camera. Then you bring that into Adobe After Effects or Premiere or whatever and sync it with the sound you've recorded. That was a process I did a few times that was very intense. And it looks great. It's fun looking. And then in the end, I just ended up going more digital, you know, where because it's the tools for inputting art into computers has gotten a lot better with tablets. Like you can use an iPad to create frames by drawing intuitively, or you can use a Wacom tablet or a Cintiq tablet where you draw on the screen. So it's gotten a lot easier to make good drawings digitally, for sure.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And I love that. And as somebody who teaches, and I know a lot of other teachers listen to this, and some number of students are subjected to listening to this in class, I do want to just highlight and emphasize there that while today you're doing digital work, I heard you talking about your excitement at learning the history of these methods and how they all come together. And I think it's really cool that you put in the time and the work to understand all the different ways that animations can be created so that you can make those informed choices. And so after a short break, we're going to get into the animations that you're doing today and, you know, how you're innovating with those tools, going beyond what I think a lot of other people have done before.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
I'm talking with Tom DeslongChamp. He is a multidisciplinary artist based out of Seattle. And, you know, for listeners who want to see your animations, I'm going to include links in the show notes to your Twitch and YouTube. And, you know, you've got your website. I'll include all the relevant links in the show notes. But I think what's most interesting to me, we've already talked a little bit about how animations are created as a series of frames and stuff like that. But you do this thing with, like, live animation. And every time I see that, I just think of, like, that Simpsons joke where Homer's the voice of Poochie and he asks, like, if the cartoon would air live. And they explained, no, it's a terrible strain on the animator's wrists. Can you just explain, how do you do that?
It came about from the program I mentioned earlier, Macromedia Flash, had a programming side to it. So you could make code on the other side of it. So you could, you know, when you use digital software to make animation, you unlock all these possibilities, like layers and something called nesting. And nesting is kind of the key word for how what I do works, because basically, to use a metaphor, it's kind of like creating a neighborhood of houses where my animation, I could have, like, my animation's a house, and then inside, or there could be or let's use a house as in there, the metaphor. I have a house, and then in the house, there's this room, and in the room, there's a closet. And think of each of these places having their own address. Like, I can send messages. I could be like, hey, closet, pull all the clothes to the left there so that we can see the back of the wall in the closet. Or in the room, move the chair 1 foot over. So when I construct animation in this program, I have the ability to link code actions to sequences. So I can combine that frame by frame idea with kind of like a Russian doll encapsulation nesting thing where one is subject to the one it's inside and that one's subject to the one it's inside. And there's this hierarchy and this ability to control these pieces. So you can tell one to loop, to play a few mm-hmm. frames over and over and over and over and over again. You can tell it to go to a certain spot. You can tell it to flip over. You can mirror it. You can scale it. You could all these attributes you can manipulate. And what ended up happening is when I was in college, actually, a game we would play in my dorm is we would draw a scene of characters in Flash. So we just draw a bunch of characters. And then I would take all the mouths and create nested, animation pieces that then I could control with buttons where I'd be like, hey, okay, when you press J, it'll make your character's mouth open. And when I press D, you know, my character's mouth will open. And hey, you can have a character too. How about you press P? We just choose random keys. I find out how to connect the code to that specific button. It's also called a key bind. And then it tells this little piece of animation to play or something like that, or to show up or disappear or whatever. So that was like the earliest version of it that was just a toy to play with in the room with people at the time. But in six or so years ago, I started revisiting that idea because live streaming had become a popular, new way to display oneself. I mean, a lot of people use it for gaming and stuff like that, or creative stuff or how-tos. I thought, how wild would it be to tune into a live stream and there be a cartoon that talks to you? That would be cool. So I started experimenting with creating different kinds of characters, and they would usually just be a head, you know, with a face and eyes, and I would make the eyes on an automatic loop that would just loop through them looking around. I wouldn't control it. It would just play. And then the mouth would be this little module where I could give it different shape mouths, and I would use different fingers to make those mouths appear. And it was like turning into a hand puppetry, but with digital art that I was creating. And that kind of thing has been done before in the last 30 years. Jim Henson's company did experiment with live rigs, or they call it rigs, characters, that even 3D ones. I never really used 3D personally. I didn't study 3D in school or anything. But these are all just me making buttons, control little 2D animation bits, you know, and I would just talk as I would press the buttons. I would talk and make the character talk. And it's really a strange experience for people. They're just like, how is this possible? How is this possible? You know, it's just blows people's minds. I mean,
that was my reaction.
Yeah.
And I know a little bit about art, and I even know a little bit about Flash, and I did a little bit with ActionScript and all of that back probably right around the same time. I never got that good. I was experimenting with like paintings and trying to make like a modular painting that like you could rearrange the pieces and have like sound attached to it, so it would create like a soundscape going along with it. But I never succeeded at it. But I find it so interesting that you're doing that. And as you're describing the process, I'm just struck by how organized you have to be and methodical in the nesting and the hierarchy and these triggers that you're creating. And ironically, you call it cartoon mess, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just feel like, I mean, the show is the name using mess is just to remind myself to keep playing. I mean, it's good to be strategic about what you want to do and be intentional, but you have to leave a little bit of room for the unknown so that you can discover things you never could have planned or written. Because I've noticed when I try to sit down and write ideas, I can't. Like I have to use my hands to generate. There's something about when I busy myself with my hands, my mind frees up. I mean, is freed up not freeze. Yeah. Freed up to explore and wander in a way that if you just handed me a microphone and I held a microphone to my mouth, I would be like, what am I saying? You know, but when I'm having to like look, the other thing about this that maybe people don't realize is that when I'm puppeting the character, I'm looking directly at the character as I do it, which is an instant feedback to me, mm-hmm. about what is happening, and it reinforces the whole thing. It's like the cycle of I'm creating movement, the movement bounces back to my eyes, and I'm like, wow, it's happening, it's alive, you know. And and I know Jim Henson's company perfected this with their, they had little TV monitors on the floor that they would look down at, or look sort of down at, and have their arm up, you know, so that they could see live what exactly the camera sees and know how it looks in the frame. So that's how they could get into the performance. Can you imagine, like, if there's any latency in the image you're seeing, it yeah. can throw the performance off. So that's why I haven't actually used, there is other ways to make live animation, and it's usually audio tracking or facial tracking. And there are yeah. some systems that do it with very low latency, like iPhone Animoji characters.
Uh-huh.
Those are extremely sharp, but they're very limited too. And most people, you don't have the ability to create your own, really, except for like with their emoji character thing. And there's also, you know, latency with Adobe Character Animator. I think you've played with that a little bit, right? Or
I've used it in limited capacities. Just yeah. like, you know, I mainly use it like when I have sub plans and I want to have you know, a unicorn giving the directions to my students or something like that. Like I'll record what I want the kids to know and then have one of those little puppets to give the directions to the kids or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious as you talk about this, because I'm just trying to envision this whole process and how you go through it. And you've already alluded to a certain amount about like your keyboard actions programmed in and stuff like that, and you're watching for that instant feedback. But if I could ask you to step back a little bit about how a character is developed, because you're not using like Adobe's puppets that you then just like modify a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're creating your own stuff. And I'm curious, does that start off with like, okay, I know I want a duck and it needs to look like this and the contours are going to be like this, and you sketch it on paper? Do you start off digitally? You know, how does the limitations or the abilities of the software affect the design choices? Mm-hmm. Can you just walk us through that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I definitely start usually digitally, because I like the ability to quickly iterate on a visual idea. I mean, paper's cool. Sometimes I'll use paper it depends. If I know I'm creating a character that I want to make into a puppet, then I definitely draw in directly in the program so that I have the art ready. Because, for instance, I have this one character called Duck, who's a duck. And Duck is the exact same drawing that I did the first time I drew him. I didn't refine him or anything. I just drew. I think the idea was I had made a cartoon version of myself and had been using that as a puppet for a while. But I was like, man, I wanted something sillier. Not just me as a cartoon. I want it to be like an animal or something. So I was like, ducks are funny. So I drew a duck, and I think I literally drew him in the first or second try or something. I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. And then I just started animating his, figuring out how his mouth would animate and how he would blink. And then I never went back. I never turned back. So it all starts with drawing. I don't really write ideas about characters. And I just play. Like I just draw some eyes and, you know, mouth or whatever, and play around till something makes me laugh or smile. You know, like usually a laugh or smile is I've created something that surprised me enough that I'm like, Oh my gosh, that's pretty good actually. But you have to stumble upon these things. In my case, yeah, I have to stumble upon them. I can't I can't overplan them or, you know, I might just have a general idea of like thin character, big character, you know, or big eyes, small eyes, you know, it's just these big sort of possibilities that I experiment with and try out. And then if it makes me laugh or feels like it's got something to it, you know, I play with it, push it further. And yeah, I don't know. It's I used another aspect of it is that I've been filling up sketchbooks for, you know, 20 years or so since college. And I used to do a lot more stream of conscious doodling in my sketchbooks than I do now. So I have this, I feel like all of that drawing for all those years of just always coming up with random characters, even just strange visuals and different ways of drawing characters. Those are like ghosts in my mind that are always ready to be like resurrected, you know, like, cause every time I create something, yeah, it's kind of floating in there in my subconscious still. So I feel like things come out again and I find patterns of character. Like I had a series called My Scum Clowns, which were these, really articulated facial features. Like I would make cheeks I would just draw circles and then fill in eyes and then I would have circle as the cheek. And I would draw these really distinct lines from each form to each form. It was me exploring forms and they were kind of like ugly and detailed in a really gross way, but I loved them and I just call them my scum clown. So it's like you find these ideas that you like and you have to just like push them. And not go, oh, well, that's not ideal or people won't like that. Or if you like it, you got to draw it. You keep drawing it. If you love it, keep doing it. That's kind of my method, I think. But sometimes it's you struggle to find something you love. You know, that's the hard part, I think, about being.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that finding the inspiration, finding the ideas, what was the old saying that inspiration finds you working, and that's why you've got sketchbook after sketchbook filled. What I'm wondering about though is as you develop a character, you said that the like duck was first or second rendition of it. As you create eyes, as you create mouths, are you having to separate them on layers? And so then, I mean, that's my understanding of it, correct? Like
right.
Each part is on a separate layer.
Yeah.
Are you so used to that you are habitually drawing different parts in layers? Because for me, I would always, when I'm drawing digitally, I make my rough draft on one layer, sketch everything out, and then I create a new layer above that and essentially like trace the contours of what I want, and then I'll separate out features on layers during that essentially tracing process.
Yeah.
But I'm curious what somebody who's good at what they do does.
Well, I mean, no, I worked the same way, Kyle. I mean, it's like it's just maybe a different mechanic. Like in Flash, you can turn on onion skinning. So what I'll do usually is I'll make a keyframe in the timeline, draw something. And then when I'm like, oh, I want to make a refine it, I make a new keyframe next to it, turn on onion skinning. So it shows me the ghost of the frame before, like a transparent, you know, copy of it.
Yeah.
And then I trace it just like you were saying. Like, I mean, in Photoshop, you could duplicate the layer and turn the transparency down. You know, it doesn't matter what program or what, it's just you're referencing the previous one and you can tell which your current lines are from, like you can tell the difference between
from how bold line. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. And but I usually will draw a character on the same layer to start because I need to draw quickly and freely and not worry about how it's being organized. So it's like an open process at first where I'm not trying to overthink what it's going to do. I need to just have the image first and then I start to break it up. And there's a setting that's kind of behaves like Illustrator. You know, an Illustrator, when you like make an element, like you'll take the pin tool and make a shape, and then you make another shape. And you know how they're always like on different layers, even though they're in a layer, they're sub layers that stack on top of each other. They never get baked together, you know? There's a setting in Adobe Animate that I always have on, and some people think I'm weird for it. Like other animators are like, why do you do that? Like, that's so weird. Why do you use that? And I'm like, because it's awesome. It's a setting called object drawing. And it basically just makes, it auto groups each stroke, just like Illustrator does basically. So when I'm drawing like duck or whatever, I'll draw a line and I get the curve kind of wrong. Well, I can continue another line, and then there are two separate forms that are kind of stacked on each other. But there's a setting called for erasing where it's erase selected. Basically, you can select a specific line and then erase it without disturbing the line that's next to it. Because you know how when you're like trying to continue a line and you want it to be smooth,
yeah,
but you erase like too much of the other line, and then you get like crunchy little edges where the lines aren't really like harmonious.
I know way too well. This is like just painful as you're describing it because I'm having visceral flashbacks. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
So think of it as like if you line up two fingers over each other, imagine if you can just select one finger and then carefully erase the parts of it that you want to erase without erasing the other finger that's right there too. You know, that's a setting I use to great degree. Like it's my way of working. Some people like to erase and hand sculpt the line again with eraser or like erase it down to a toothpick and then do a bold line over that. You know, like there are different methods and teach their own. But you asked about like how I draw and whether I use layers. That's basically, I use sub layers kind of. I like it also because you can adjust, you can grab the line and then scale that line to make it longer without messing with the other part. You know, I find it very modular and neat to work that way. Yeah. And then when it comes to rigging, the secondary step of rigging, then I'll like, you know, grab the chunks, like, oh, the eyes, I'll copy paste those in the new layer and then create, like giving them an address, like I was saying with code. You literally, it's like grouping. You group the art and then you give it a name. And then if you make another group inside that one, you know, it might be like the main one might be head, and then inside that one might be eyes, you know, and then inside the eyes might be pupils. I needed to control those. So it's a hierarchy that mimics other structures in our world, or it's whatever you imagine it to be. But so that's kind of the gist of it. Yeah. And then it's just buttons, choosing which buttons do what and trying to make it make sense ergonomically for my hand to easily jump between them. I use a lot of muscle memory, so I don't have to look at the keys anymore unless it's some big jump, you know, like from across the keyboard to hit some weird key, you know. I also have little there's these I don't know what the word is, but they're for they're kind of like braille, like little buttons.
Yeah, like the little tactile things on there so that you can know it by touch.
I definitely use those because they've got a set where you can get ones that have a dot or two dots or a line, and you can get the sense of where your hand is by getting to know that where those dots are and stuff. So, yeah.
So we've kind of started to get into the weeds of like how you go about stuff, what your creative process is. I guess to wrap things up, because I know a lot of young people love animation and can use it in a lot of different ways. What advice would you give to aspiring animators or artists in general, whether it's specific hacks that ease the workflow or just like broader insights into how you approach creative tasks?
Well, in a general sense, I recommend what I said earlier about like trying out different things so you can find out whether you like something. And then when you find that you like something, embrace it. Like, don't be embarrassed. Love it. Like, just own it. If you like drawing faces, draw faces all the time. Don't feel like you have to be good at drawing cars if you don't like drawing cars. You know, try to learn how to draw them, but don't don't get mad at yourself if you're not good at it, because maybe you don't like it, you know. Do the things you like. And then the other thing about, like, practically is it's actually easier than ever to dip your hand or your toe into the waters of animation, because tablets are really great tools for drawing intuitively, because that's one thing that really tripped up a lot of people in the last 20 years is if you get a Wacom tablet or a bamboo tablet, like the little black USB stylus things where you don't actually look at a screen, you look at your monitor, but you're drawing down on the table watching your mouse move. It's like a glorified mouse. That really throws a lot of people off, that they can't look at their hand as they draw. So tablets are a really cool gateway to making art digitally. And there are programs for tablets to make animation, but my one beef with those programs is that they're usually limited. So I've seen some kids or students go down the path of learning a way to animate in a program on their tablet. And then when it comes to making the jump to computers, they struggle a lot with key commands and keyboard usage and knowing how to switch off between using a mouse and a keyboard, or I mean, and a tablet to draw. So I would say just prepare your, if you've grown up with a tablet and you love drawing on it, I would just say prepare your hearts for combining tactile input devices. Because some kids, I tutor some animation, some kids for animation, and I seen one kid, he's really good on the, you know, on his tablet, but it's been a challenge to get him to use the Wacom tablet on the computer. Like it just doesn't feel good to him. So he doesn't like using it. And I'm just like, well, if you want to do more animation, you either need to buy like a $2,000 monitor that you can draw on the computer. Well, there are cheaper ones, by the way, but or, you know, maybe get used to using drawing with your hand, not looking at your hand, you know, which does take getting used to. But yeah, it's tricky. But and just, you know, and key commands open up your world to efficient, you know, creativity. But there's a learning curve where you have to get used to using it, and that's hard. So I would say just prepare your bodies and minds for using various input devices, not just a touchscreen, because touchscreen is limited, extremely limited. Like, you cannot get muscle memory with a touchscreen. You have to look at everything you touch because you can't feel it. And keyboards you can feel. So yeah, that's the gist, I guess.
So what I'm hearing you say is be unabashed and dive headfirst into the things that you love and embrace those things you love, but also remain open to learning about methods and tools that may not be something you love at first, because it will open you up and build your capacity to succeed further and take things to a next level.
Yeah.
Is that right?
It's kind of like the difference between having toys and tools. I mean, a tablet is more like a toy. You can make serious art with it, but it's limited. It's like in a little corral that doesn't, you can't go really vast with it. So I would just say, if you want to make serious art, like serious animation, I guess you could say, with it pushes the work further and helps you train yourself as an artist, you're gonna have to get off the tablet eventually. Unless tablet software increases a lot, but then at that point you're just using a computer where you might just have your tablet on a stand and using a keyboard and a mouse on a tablet. I mean, it starts to not matter at a certain point, you know, like what it is, you know, it's just a machine that processes visual information and audio information as you interact with it. So try different tools. Keyboard, mice, and Wacom tablets are awesome, but they take training, I guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you once again. I really appreciate your taking the time. Tom Deslongchamp, amazing multidisciplinary artist. Again, I'm going to put all the links in the show notes. Cartoon Mess on Twitch and amazing marker drawings that still I look at and am amazed that it's ink and not pastel or paint. But I love all the things you're doing, so keep being awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.